everybody. Welcome to another episode of Innovation Crush.
Innovation Crush.
Actually, wait. You know, I was listening to a couple of shows and I realized that most of the times I don't wait for you to do the echo.
You don't.
So, thank you. I actually even gestured to you to open the stage and the floor for you.
Like Big Sean, I do it.
Like Big Sean, you do it. Mm-hmm. Speaking of doing it, we have an amazing guest with us today. Say hello, Z.
Hey.
You do go by Z, right?
I do.
All right.
Yeah. Why not?
No EE, no J, no.
Just one letter. Just although one sometimes I get Zed when I'm in other countries.
Hey, Zed. You're like, no.
It's all right. Or Vegas, maybe.
I'll let it slide.
Exactly. Why just the Z?
Well, so I'm Hungarian. My parents are Hungarian. And so my name, Christina, has a Z in it. And it's just a lot easier to spell Z than Christina with a Z in there.
Damn Hungarian spellings. Did you grow up in Hungary or did you grow up here in the coastal United States?
I grew up in the U.S., but my parents were refugees from Hungary. So a lot of their past stories have had a really big impact on my life.
That's pretty interesting. Yeah. Well, what were they refugeing from?
Oh, so they left Hungary.
Seeking refuge. I don't know how to use the word refugee outside of the word refugee.
Right. So they were seeking refuge from 1956. It was an uprising in Hungary against the Soviets. And so they had been under Soviet occupation for a long time. And there were some pretty crazy stories about my father being held at gunpoint, barely making it across after this river. Other people in his group were shot. My mother and her family basically being able to bring whatever they were wearing. That was it. They maybe put an extra pair of pants on, and that was it.
Yeah.
Coming to this country, not knowing the language barely, and you know, just not knowing if they'd ever go back to their home country. And so I think it's a lot of the same DNA that entrepreneurs and innovators have, just kind of going off into the unknown.
It is like, was it like the muscle memory? Or ancestral memory, right?
Right?
Like
exactly.
You have this sort of like exploration tent to yourself.
Well, yeah. You hear those stories and it's hard to not appreciate what you have. And
yeah, that's amazing.
And my parents are, you know, took me on a lot of adventures. So
and good food, too.
Yeah.
Hungarian food
definitely.
Is amazing. So I'm going to read your Twitter bio. Entrepreneur, engineer, troublemaker, muses on new ideas, startups, innovation, LA adventure, Forbes contributor, council chair at Davos, TEDx, previous at MIT and USC. Explain yourself. That was like a lot of stuff. That was like three people's lives in one, you know, one blurb.
I guess you could say that I'm a very curious person. And so I love to just follow my curiosity and try different things. So, yeah, I started out as an engineer. And started my first company with colleagues out of grad school at MIT, and then went on and was involved in other startups. Did a little stint between startups and documentary production, and then my last two startups were, if you want to call them startups, they were innovation centers at universities. So I was actually, what's kind of neat about that is that I was able to help other people then achieve entrepreneurial success, innovation,
right,
make an impact in the world. I was at MIT and then most recently at USC.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So how did, like, as I get, like, kind of following your curiosity in the moment, you know, and going from, you know, kind of just walk us through the journey as how those things kind of, like, how you blossomed into where you are today. Like, you know, what was the first thing where really I think for me is kind of like, what was the first thing that sparked your curiosity? And then you go, it just becomes a way for you, right?
Yeah, I think so. I think that... My parents, I think I was lucky in some sense that I was an only child and that my parents were very adventurous. My dad, when I was 6 months old, he'd go off on treasure hunting trips to different, you know, to South America.
Really?
And, yeah. And of course, my mother was not exactly pleased because she wanted to go, right?
Right.
But he would say, oh, well, you know, I'm going off to, he would justify it. Well,
you need to watch the house.
Yeah. he was going because he was getting some, finding gold or emeralds, whatever, so that he could put me through college one
right.
day.
Sounds
you know, that. So that was the environment. And then when I was maybe five, we went to Belize, which was British Honduras at the time. And
right.
My dad told my mother, you know, good news for Christmas, we're going to the Caribbean. And she, I mean, she's very adventurous, but she thought, right. Oh, Caribbean, I'll pack the long evening gowns, a steam iron. Next thing you know, fast forward to Christmas Eve, we're in the jungle. Our Jeep has broken down. We're trying to find the lost city of Lubantun or something like this. Right. And you know, then we finally make our way to some person's oasis in the middle of the jungle, and we're swimming in these hot springs with piranhas, you know, but little baby piranhas. Yeah. I mean, just crazy stuff like that. And so that was the early stages of just the curiosity. And I think a lot of people say, I don't want to take my kids on travel because I'm going to wait until they're going to remember it.
Right.
Well, the truth is, I remember things from when I was 2.5 years old.
Yep.
But even if I didn't, those things absolutely set you up for the rest of your values for the rest of your life.
Well, not only that, I have an 8-year-old, and I even this morning I was showing her pictures of stuff she had done when she was a baby, one or younger.
Yeah.
And it's just like, oh, really? And like you retell that story, and like suddenly it's ancestral memory again.
That's right.
And like, oh, I did do that.
Exactly. I remember my dad. My mom didn't believe that I actually remember. She didn't remember this really. I remembered before we moved from Boston to D.C., and that was before I was 3 because that's when we moved. So right. I was really young. My dad actually took me onto the roof of the house to just hang out on the roof of the house up this ladder. And I was like, he wouldn't have done that. Well, about 8 years later, we find a photograph that she had taken of me and my dad on the roof of the house.
So the theme I'm getting here is that your mom was kind of just left out of all these experiences.
She wanted to be part of it. I know. She knows. She's actually very – I took her backpacking for a month in Ecuador.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So she's really – she's down with the adventure.
I want to be your mom.
Yeah, can we go?
Take me on some of these trips. We'll be your mother. So one of your claims to fame is that you are credited with the first TEDx event, which Robert and I thought was the porn version TEDx. But apparently, we were wrong. My other joke was Ted Z, but I'm gonna skip that one.
That was my idea, but they said, go with us.
How does that happen for you? You know, do you, you just like pick up the phone like, hey, I got an idea?
Well, I think, I think it's a combination of, luck of having really good connections and saying, hey, let's just make, propose, let's go talk to Chris Anderson. And so a friend of mine, a colleague had put me in touch, and we had lunch, and we hashed out. A colleague of mine, Elisa, and I went and had lunch with Chris Anderson, and we said that TED.com is awesome. We think it's great. Some people think it's crazy that you're putting all the content out there, but we think it's great. You're making it available, but it's not the TED experience, and we'd really like to bring the TED experience to our community. I'm sure that other people have proposed this to you too.
Right.
But what we're really passionate about is making this a replicable model. So, let's do one. Let's do a pilot. And if it fails, we don't have to tell anybody that we tried it. We did it. Yeah.
It's like a deep, dark basement. Yeah, and you're like, we're not telling you where you're going. Just come on.
So I think, and Chris had been thinking of a lot of these things too. Chris, I have to credit Chris as being this really forward thinker in terms of opening things up and sharing things with the world in ways that's very uncomfortable for leaders.
Right.
And at first he said, I'm really interested, but he says, no, we're not quite ready yet. And I thought, he's just letting us down easy. Well, 4 months later, he calls back. He says, you know what? We're ready. We have the right person on team to lead this, Laura Stein, who's amazing. I mean, she's really the one who
championed it,
create the program within TED. And so we worked with her to help identify, what would be the licensing model, what would be the standards that groups would have to do. So every time that we were trying to make a decision about our event. Normally, if you're licensing something, you want to push the boundaries and you want to get as much as possible.
Right.
We're thinking, oh my God, well, this is also, we're setting precedent for all the other organizations that may, if this takes off, they'll be having to meet these standards. And so we want to make sure that the standards are high. And so we were kind of pushing ourselves in both directions. We wanted as much control as possible. And at the same time, we wanted to make sure that, we wanted to make sure this was a really good program.
Yeah. No, I mean, especially with something like TED, you have to have some level of creative freedom and on stage and who people can curate and, so.
Well, that's one of the most brilliant things about TEDx too, is that for an organization to really let go enough so that the idea can localize and can have the local champions and the evangelists can take ownership of it.
Right.
And shape it to make sense there. So you'll have a TEDx that's in the slums of Kenya where there's literally dirt floor, there's 30 people in the room and a little flip chart, or not even that, you know?
Yeah.
And which is a far cry from a TEDx USC, which we did, which is a huge production and 1,200 people and just really super high production value. Yeah. And, but they both are a great way of having ideas worth spreading that are contextualized for the environment.
Yeah, and it's setting up that thread. And you mentioned like a four-month gap. Like what happens in that four-month gap? You know, because I think a lot of our listeners who are entrepreneurs who are building things or going out and making things happen. But sometimes like you get discouraged in a 4 month gap. Uh-huh. You're like, all right, forget it. Like you move on to the next thing. And by the time you get that phone call, it's too late.
Right.
So what was that process like? Were you in constant communication or were you just waiting?
No, you know, I think that we had a lot of things on our plate. So at the time I was the vice provost for innovation at USC and I was was the founding director of the USC Stevens Institute for Innovation. And so we were working with students to try to help them start companies. We were managing the intellectual property for the university.
Right.
We were doing all sorts of things.
So you were busy.
It was just another so we're gonna see. So our philosophy was about experimentation. So we'd throw out things, see what would stick. And I think part of the challenge is first to come up with crazy ideas, but it's not about coming up with the crazy ideas. It's actually trying them out, figuring out which ones to pursue and executing.
Right.
There's a lot of emphasis and innovation these days about coming up with new ideas. An idea is just an idea until you execute it. And so you need to figure out what's the best way. It's not just about doing it, but you need to make sure that it's the market's ready for it. Your internal organization is ready for the idea.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a lot of preparation that needs to happen. So that's a lot of the things we're experimenting.
Yeah.
And it's just as hard to kill ideas as it is to come up with ideas.
It is hard.
Especially
it's hard
in a university
water.
Environment.
Yeah.
Chris kills a lot of my ideas instantly.
Oh, yes. Other people's ideas.
But to your point, like, how long did it take you to kind of like really kind of flesh that out and like, you know, hone in on that idea and really like fine tune it to the point where it is TEDx, you know?
Well, so again, I want to be really clear too that I don't want to take credit for actually creating the entire program.
Too late.
Right?
No,
but it's an iterative process. And so working with Laura early, so she started, let's see, we started talking probably in 2008. So we had the idea with Chris in 2007 that and then in the fall in November. He shot us down. No, not really. In January. No, he let us
people
down
named Chris, huh?
you see our budget for sound effects here. I don't have any buttons. Or...
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, let's see. So maybe it was early summer we started talking with Laura. And the event itself was next May. So it was a long process of just talking through what this might look like.
Right.
We really started putting together the program in September. And again, of course, this was not the only thing that we were working on. Mm-hmm. But it's also, there's this gestation period. And I think one of the things that I really enjoy is, and this is what I've realized now, a lot of times you don't realize what you were doing all along until you look back. And you're like, yeah, that's what I was doing all along. I knew exactly what I was doing, right? But it's about really helping empower other people to make an impact and to help identify undiscovered ideas and talent, helping them amplify their ideas. So whether it's helping students start companies or faculty license their technologies to a big company and turn it into a product, or identifying good speakers for TEDx, you're really trying to find really great people and ideas. And so that takes time. That's just so sometimes things, it just have to, it's good to do things in parallel. And they won't happen overnight.
Right.
I usually save this for the end, but I feel inspired. How about that?
Whoa.
Yeah, I know, right? I never get moments of inspiration.
Inspiring you?
Yes. So I want you to finish a phrase for me.
Okay.
Innovation to me is?
Making impact.
How so?
So, like I said before, it's there's a lot of emphasis about innovations, about being new ideas.
Mm-hmm.
An idea is just in your head, and an invention is just for you. You just have one thing. That's not really going to do the world a lot of good. But it's really not until you can have that idea get accepted in the marketplace. And I'm not talking about, it doesn't have to necessarily be a technological gadget. You know, it could be a policy idea. It could be, you know, who knows? It could be a whole bunch of different things. I mean, just even the, you know, concepts like condominium. You know, the idea of a condominium as opposed to just renting an apartment. That
right.
was an innovation that really enabled people to own a home, even if they couldn't afford a house.
Yeah.
So it's not a product. It's not a technological product, but it's an important innovation.
Yeah.
So that so I think that it's really about turning that idea into impact.
I like that. I mean, that's kind of one of my personal philosophies, and we've talked about this before, where it's like, a lot of people look at innovation as the end product, right? They don't look at it as the process, or solving a problem, you know, or even for somebody to, in the condominium example, to go like, how can we make lower costs? Like, you know, was it a sales problem they were trying to solve? Was it a space, you know, a spatial problem they were trying to solve? Or was it just like an overpopulation problem? And then you go, okay, cool. Like, here's, what if we, you know, made really smaller houses and put them in buildings, you know, which sounds crazy, but, right. But that's what happens.
Well, there's a fine line between innovative and insane sometimes.
yeah, we won't go into that just yet. So when you get involved in a project, right. You know, what are your clients and or colleagues in for? Like, when they're like, let's call Z. You know, what you come to the table, because I feel like a lot of times when you're the ideas and processes person, it's sometimes hard to define. And I know it probably means different things for different projects. But, you know, kind of what are people expecting when Z walks in?
I don't know what they're expecting, what they get. No, I think some of the most important, part about innovation is asking the right questions. So,
how am I doing so far?
You're doing great.
Robert asked a good question.
But if you were to ask me, okay, I'm going to start getting into this different troublemaker mode. Okay, you don't want that. No, but you know, it's like, oh no, you know, not like, oh, why? How do we solve X? Like, how do we create a better snack food? But what's the actual? Why is snack food even appealing to us? And can we get at the same sensory, you know, the effects in other ways? Or, you know, taking a step back.
Yep.
It's not a good example. I told you I'm not good.
No, it's a great example. I'm in the middle of this book called The Power of Habit, Why We Do the Things We Do in Life and Business, which Charles Duhigg has been invited to the show, just so you know, the author. But it's exactly that, right? They talk about habits, both good and bad, and even the neuroscience that goes into how habits form, you know, because you're basically, what happens is your brain makes room for you to do new things. So it automates, you know, certain things. So like, oh, I need a cigarette, doesn't become like an effort anymore. It becomes, or the example they use in the book was backing out of the driveway, right? When you first learned how to drive, you were like checking the mirror, you know, turning, like make sure the steering wheel, and now you can just back out of the driveway super easy.
My mother taught me, don't back out of the driveway, you back into the driveway. Then you can make a quick getaway.
She's like, I know where they're going. They're going to the island of Moreau. I just made it. I meant to say Dr. Moreau, but anyway.
It's funny you say that, though, because I was actually watching the Stephen Colbert show the other night. And
I've heard of it.
Really?
Yeah.
Stephen Colbert is definitely invited here as well, if you're going to do a shameless plug. But he had a guest on, and he was talking about his book, and he was actually talking about how the mind actually forgets and how that's actually useful.
Yes, I saw that one. I was thinking the exact same thing. And, a woman who was, I guess, here at UCLA, they were nearby. They've been doing some research on people who cannot forget.
Yeah.
Things, and you'd think at first that it's a wonderful skill to be able to remember exactly what you're doing at every moment, every day. No, it'd just be absolutely maddening because
terrifying.
You don't need to know the details. It's the big picture, and I think that there's a lot of paradoxes in entrepreneurship and innovation. I think that one of them is the need to both think in the big picture, see the long-term vision, but at the same time be able to execute it at an absolute detailed level and just focus.
Right.
And just put everything else out, you know?
Yeah. Where do you start? Like, do you start with the creative end product, or do you start with the questions, right? Like, sometimes, you know, it's, ooh, let's cast a big creative vision and then fill in the tactical pieces. Or is it kind of, or, you know, what is your process when you are tackling a new issue or a new opportunity?
Well, what's kind of interesting about the last decade, well, up until when I left USC, in the universities, we took a sometimes very contrarian approach, because normally you learn in business school or wherever that you start with the opportunity and then you try to come up with a solution. And I'm still very much a proponent of that, but that's very much more of like a cultivation, a farming kind of an approach where you're trying to cultivate these ideas right. that are going to be really good. When you have, you know, like a university like USC or MIT, and you have $1 billion, on the order of $1 billion of research every year, wow. there's a huge, it's like ore. You're mining for nuggets.
Yep.
You don't need every single one of those ideas to be great. And it's the opposite, where you start with the technology, and then you figure out what are the applications for it.
Yeah.
And most people say, no, that's not the way you're supposed to do it. Well, when you have this amazing opportunity of riches, where you have all this innovation,
yeah.
there's tons of opportunities and applications. So the real trick is to connect those, dots.
With that, you kind of touch on the idea of collaboration. You know, breeding innovation, where I think there was a period of time where innovation happened in a vacuum. Mm-hmm. But now when you've touched on a lot of entrepreneurs and that whole ecosystem of people just building things all the time, and they haven't necessarily been launched into a marketplace. But, you know, if I'm building a, you know, widget Y and Robert has, you know, an application that's proper for it, like, let's come together and see what we have now. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, a perfect example is the Ogilvy Innovation Lab. Is they'll work with new technologies, but they can apply them to, you know, the Ogilvy portfolio of clients.
Right.
Right. So
I'm all about leveraging and replicating, and, you know, and that's the, you know, idea behind TEDx, but also other things that we had done. And I love to see. So at MIT, we created the Deshpande Center, which gave grants, proof of concept grants, to faculty and students that wanted to advance their research into the market.
What does Deshpande mean?
The donor, Desh Deshpande, and his wife Jayshree, he's been a very successful entrepreneur, founded Sycamore Networks, and he gave a large $20 million gift to MIT and founded the Deshpande Center. So, so, you know, I had the fortune to kind of help create, you know, there was a vision, but help define the model and how this can actually work. And we've seen the model of this innovation center giving out these innovation grants and bringing in and using them as a magnet to bring together really amazing faculty and students and ideas and mentors from the outside business community. And that's been just replicated all around the world. Yeah, so it's just so really rewarding to see that.
It's like the perfect formula for innovation. I don't want to keep – I know the show is called Innovation Crush, but we keep using the word. So you're also a recovering skydiver.
Yeah, exactly.
Obviously, you were successful because you're here.
Still successful so far. But I did have a little bit of an incident, actually.
Did you?
Did you?
I did.
Did you bounce? Did you do the Z bounce?
Well, fortunately, I had a reserve parachute.
Wow.
No way.
Mm-hmm. Eighth jump. Can you believe it? It was the final jump before I could go solo. So, yeah. And
fail.
Yeah, and you know, I was with an instructor, but the moment you pull your parachute, your instructor keeps falling, and you're slowing down a little bit,
right.
But it never opened, and I started spinning wildly. And fortunately, it was still while I'd been doing really intensive instruction, because I knew I'd been practicing exactly what I do, but even still, it was so hard to lift my arms, because the centrifugal force was so strong. Mm-hmm. It took about 10 seconds, and I don't even want to think about how far I dropped in that time frame, but it was an incredible
9.8
rush.
Meters per second per second.
That's it how, was very...
Just so you know.
I'm not going to do the math. No, so it was funny. And my mother, who was waiting, she loved to go with me, and she would always take pictures of me, right? And my parachute was usually green and yellow, and so I landed with a red parachute this time. And she said, "You didn't tell me you were going to have a red parachute." She was all really, you know, upset. And I said, "That was not intentional."
Nobody told me I was going to have a red
And I had this incredible, just really adrenaline rush, obviously, that made me excited and thrilled at the time. But then it made it really hard to come back. My first solo jump was the one right after I had that experience.
Like the next day? How long?
No, it was actually, and unfortunately, it was like 3 weeks. So by the time I was able to go back. So I was anxious, and I was down on myself. I was so down on myself for being nervous, because I hadn't been that nervous about jumping out of the airplane. It's not jumping out of the airplane for me that's scary. It's the pulling the parachute. That's the moment of truth, right?
Oh, because that's when you're safe or not.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, But there was a pretty famous person in the airplane with me who's known for his daredevil acts. I'm not going to say who it was. And he was learning how to skydive. Mm-hmm. He was really nervous. And when I saw that, I felt like, you know what? It's okay to be nervous.
Was it Mr. T?
No, I'm not.
Okay. Remember in A-Team, Mr. T used to always be scared to get in airplanes? So anyway, speaking of segues, speaking of segues in all seriousness, I think part of that, like, ability to take the leap, you know, to jump, right? To just do that. Especially when you take on a project, I wanted to know, what does it feel like when you actually get your clients or your business partners to jump with you? You know, what is that what is that feeling?
You know, I really feel like for me, because I've been on my own, this is my bearing my soul right now, but, you know, like being on my own for a year and a half, just on this creative sabbatical, you know, I have some ideas on things that I want to work on, but have been really exploring. And, you know, I will admit that I have something in the back of my mind that I've wanted to try for a long time, and I've been kind of working on it in the background, but I've been dragging my feet, and so I normally think of myself as being an extremely fearless person about certain things, and I find that the best way sometimes when I'm finally getting momentum is by not that I have to convince other people, but actually having other people that are bought into the vision. And it harkens back to the first startup where we had three founders, and we, you know, let's say I'd be down one day, but then one of my partners is like, no, we figured it out, you know, like make a solution to that problem, or no, you know, we're going to do great. And and they've actually done studies that show that the more people, up to five, that you have in a startup, founders, the more successful you're going to be. And I think a lot of that is balancing out that roller coaster. It's an absolute roller coaster. And let me tell you, people who start companies, that they'll so many people will give a talk about their successes, right? You only ask successful entrepreneurs usually to tell their stories, right? And, you know, 20/20 hindsight, first of all, you have survivor bias. You're only talking to someone who was successful. And then they love to just remember everything that they did right and how smart they were, right?
Right.
And
they can't forget those things.
No,
back to our other study.
They're, you know, you do not know, as experienced as an entrepreneur as you are, every time you take on a new venture, a new idea, you don't know the outcome. If you knew the outcome, and if you knew it were going to be successful, people would have already done it, right?
Right.
So you're taking that risk. So anybody who says they knew all along what they were doing is lying, or they're completely fooling themselves.
Right.
So I think that it's important for, you know, entrepreneurs or entrepreneur wannabes to kind of realize that there's this entrepreneurial angst that you go through constantly of you don't know what's next.
Yeah.
Remember when we launched our first product with Stylus Innovation, the first startup, and actually it was the second product actually, the first one we had licensed, and this was the one that really kind of made us successful. We were at Comdex, a big computer show. The three founders of us looked at each other. We go, oh my God, what if nobody buys this product? And we said, oh my God, what if everybody buys this product? How do we fulfill it? How do we support it? Oh, what's going to happen? And then we looked at each other. We said, one day when we become millionaires, let's not forget this day that we had no idea what was going to happen next. And like, we swore to each other that we're never going to forget that day, because it's, you don't know what the outcome is.
Freeze frame on the group high five.
Exactly. Totally.
No, it is great, because I think, you know, that entrepreneurial journey, I think there are certain like things you do learn along the way, like you at least there was a guy named Oliver Bogner who was on the show. And one of the points that he made was he never did something just because, right? He always had like a goal in mind, right? Even though entrepreneurs don't necessarily know where you're going to end up. That's why I always think valuations are funny, just because you're like, that's right, 20 million. And it's based on some fact and some track record and some things like that. But at the end of the day, you don't know. But I think good entrepreneurs also, you know, it's kind of like playing a game of basketball, right? Like, you kind of know the fundamentals of the game, but you just, there's certain, whether they're personality traits or practice because you've done it so many times before, or just certain things that kick in that kind of help to foster that success or not success.
And those definitely become more just you don't even think about those right. things. And so you work on the innovations on top of that. I have a very good friend who's a professional skateboarder, and he talks about that, about how, I mean, you look at what he does. He's invented almost all the street skateboarding tricks out there, you know, and for him, a lot of those things, they're just really easy. And right. so he just adds on top of it. He links them together, almost like language.
Right. right.
Like little phrases and words and phrases.
It's really interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, it's funny, like, when people have a gift, right? There's one of, speaking of Z's, Jay-Z said that, he said for a long time, he didn't realize that what he had was a gift because it came easy to him.
Right.
Right. And I think that happens with, you know, a lot of people who, like, there are certain things that come natural to you and you go, well, okay. Like,
that's why you never want to take lessons, ski lessons or whatever lessons from someone who's really good at something, because usually it comes so easy to them, they don't remember, or it's been so long that they're a beginner that they don't right. understand the things that you're struggling with. So that's sometimes one of the gifts of somebody who's a really good teacher is to somebody who can really break it down to the point where what is it that you're struggling with, and what is the misperceptions, what
right.
are the myths or other things that
to
you
that point, I've, like mm-hmm. I feel like in a way I've become smarter as a parent.
Yeah.
Because I have to go back to so many basics, especially a third grader. I'm like, you know, whether it's social studies, you know, or we're talking about constellations or just a trick to remember, like to know how to do a story problem, you know, just to go back to those really rooted basics and revisit them is just from a, you know, 30 years later or whatever.
It makes you feel good. You actually learned something.
Yeah.
I do know something.
Yeah, exactly. Now, next year, fourth grade, who knows?
Why is it that when you're like, there's a certain point in life, early in life, where you think you know everything, and then you just feel like you're getting dumber and dumber as you get older, because you realize how much you don't know.
Exactly. The only thing that we know fully is that we know nothing.
Well, that's another entrepreneurial paradox, right?
Have you guys been watching Are You Smarter Than a Fifth Grader?
Exactly. That's a little bit humbling. Well, so that's one of the paradoxes of entrepreneurship is sort of this combination of both optimism and confidence and humility, right?
Yeah.
Because you need to have the persistence to just push forward and just see your idea through. And
right.
at the same time, you need to know when to stop. And when people are saying, that's a really dumb idea, you know, sometimes you need to just keep pushing through. And there are other times you're like, wait, why is everyone saying this is a dumb idea? And they may be totally wrong. That might be why nobody else has tried this. But you need to get at the question of, why do they think it's a dumb idea?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And in fact, that was our first startup, the software package that we came out with. We had surveyed 500 computer telephony experts on the idea that we had. We wanted to create this Windows-based computer telephony development tool, whatever that is, right? Like, whatever. So
I think I just drooled a little bit. Sorry.
Every single person, except for I think 3 or 4 of them, said that is the dumbest idea I've ever heard. And we're like, oh my God, what are we going to do next? Well, the truth is, we thought we did it anyway, because we realized that those people had a vested interest in keeping it as complex as possible and as inaccessible to other developers. So what we did was we came out with a $500 tool, no runtime fees. Totally accessible. Our sales of this product surpassed AT&T's product within 18 months in terms of volume.
Wow.
And so, of course, they don't want everybody and his brother or her brother to be able to do this, because that was their bread and butter. So when you think about why people are saying that's a bad idea, then it can give you a little bit of a perspective.
No, that's great. Yeah, because even whether it's a creative process or a marketing tactic or whatever, it's kind of like you always have to examine the pros and cons, the do's and don'ts, the feedback, you know, it's just it's a juggling act.
Yeah,
you know?
No doubt.
When do you stop?
When do you stop?
Yes.
What?
I don't know. If you like on that idea, like, is it
when you retire?
When your heart stops. When you're developing that idea, like maybe the feedback has been like, this is awesome, you know, and you're like, okay,
you run out of money and you've lost your house.
Exactly. No. Like, it's like the jerk.
No, I mean, you know what it is? I think that that's a good question. That's a philosophical question, right? But let me think back on the different examples. I think a lot of times I feel like, you know, two different perspectives. One is, I think that the idea should evolve, right? So it's not a binary thing. Like, oh, that's a good idea, that's a bad idea, let's just stop doing it.
Right.
Take the feedback and make it better. And the other one is, I think that sometimes you don't have, you know, it's not your only idea, right? It's not your last idea. It's not your only idea. And that's why I think actually the first sabbatical I took after the first startup was really hard for me, because after 6 months, I was, just wonderful, you know, it was vacation, yeah. whatever I want. Not only was I a little bit bored, because I really enjoy, I mean, not bored, but I enjoy having a purpose, right? But also, I was asking myself, am I still going to have the fire in the belly? Was that my last idea? Because it was my first idea, I had no idea if I could do it again. And now that I've done it many times, this sabbatical is going a lot better 18 years later. It's still challenging, you know? Like in society, we ascribe a lot of value to people based on how busy they are, what title they have, you know? Yeah. And it's and when you meet somebody at a party in the United States anyway, people will say, what do you do, right? I don't have an easy elevator pitch. I'm doing a lot of stuff, you know?
Well, I got this.
Right, so I'm pretty busy. But, you know, it's not, it doesn't really tell, you know, who you are as a person. But it's hard to come to terms with that, right? Like, it took me about 6 months to feel okay with the fact that I don't have 100 emails coming in every day anymore. Of course, by the end of those 6 months, I started getting 100 emails a day again. So it's sort of a, I kind of got back into the swing of things pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Without meaning to, but.
No, I think that's what just one of those things. It is kind of like, you know, when you do the kind of things you do as a service to the world, you know, and it is kind of project based, and you're going from one, you know, fundamentally a startup to another. Right. You've invest so much of your personal energy and emotion and things into the process, and once it's done, it's like you're meshed with it,
right?
You know,
no doubt.
It's like giving birth.
Well,
and
I'm not quite ready.
Away.
I mean, I think that's part of it, is that I feel like I only have so many in me, you know, in a lifetime, and so I feel like I want to make sure that the next thing, if I'm really going to go,
oh, you're endless.
One thing,
you're endless.
Well, this is the problem, is by not wanting to get too involved or committed to one thing, I end up getting overcommitted to many things. So,
have you been married?
I'm married.
Oh, okay, all right.
Still am.
Sorry, Robert. He told me to ask that.
He still tolerates me.
Well, no, I want to. I was going to ask you this idea of, I mean, the flip side of the elation that you feel when the team gets it, right? The freeze frame high five, and we're all in this together. And then I would imagine that there's a flip side to that where you go, you're in a room and you're talking to people and it is not gelling, right? Because you're bringing a very different perspective, a wide-eyed view of the possibilities and what needs to happen in order to make some of these things happen. Just what are some of the hurdles that you face, you know, in some of the day-to-day things you've taken on and converting, right? Converting, because you have to be an evangelist for the idea.
Well, I think that a good example is, so communications is a really important piece of innovation, and it's not just important to just market an idea once you've already created it, but it's about getting the input, and it's about also, and it's not just outside, but it's also inside your organization. So you need to make sure that everybody on the team is going along with you the whole way. And there's a lot of focus these days on design, right? But I think that there's two other pieces that people don't really focus on as much. One is the communication piece, and which is just as much about listening as talking. And the other one is this imagination piece. And it's kind of a virtuous cycle. So I feel like you might communicate, you get some ideas. You're also creating the space for imagination so people can imagine this new future.
Right.
And it creates a space for that idea so that then you can put that idea in there, or it can help they can help develop it. So it's that imagination piece is really important. And then once that imagination piece is activated, then you can design what makes sense. And then based on the design, then you know, are communicating. It's a sort of virtuous cycle. In an entrepreneurial environment, purely a startup, you have to communicate, obviously, outside the world and within your team. I've been in environments where I had an entrepreneurial team within a very complex bureaucratic organization in academia, so both universities, and any large company is similar. And I think, so this is maybe another topic, but large companies are completely underestimated in their value and role in innovation. Okay, so I just, parking lot, right? But I think that's really important. But it's really hard because, you know, I had to manage up as much as I had to manage down. And in large organizations, everything's measured. And that's the idea of the bigger a company gets, the more it wants to become more efficient. And how you drive efficiency is based on trying to get all of the fat out of the system. But in doing that, you're missing a lot of the real creative energy and the different ideas that are creating the innovation. So innovation and entrepreneurship are both very wasteful processes in a sense. I mean, think about in entrepreneurship. You have all these startups. Most of them fail. Right. And then some of them, and maybe not even the best ones, survive. So I think that is really incompatible with a larger organization in general. So usually big companies are looking for ways of measuring innovation, and you can't really measure it that well.
No, you have to let people play. Like you have to allow playtime, you know, and you never know. Like, I mean, you watch a kid play. You're like, oh, wow, you made a boat out of those things? Like, but, you know, when you bought the set of Lincoln Logs or whatever, you weren't thinking, like, go build a boat.
Unfortunately, you know, there was a lot of trust, and the, you know, the person who had hired me at USC, who became the president, you know, he trusted me a lot. So I had a lot of opportunity to play and say it. Same at MIT. I mean, MIT is incredibly... a place that's really, you don't think of it as play, but you can... I mean, a place that where you can... take apart a cop car and put it on the roof of the dome and then not get in trouble, but in fact they celebrate you and they put you in a book that they sell in the gift shop.
And Harvard and Yale, like, don't they
yeah, do the that? Harvard Yale game, yeah. Right. So that type of the hacking, they call it, you know, mentality, it's all about play. It's all about, as long as no one's getting hurt, it's great.
Yeah. Well, I guess I won't hurt you again, Robert. I'm sorry. I'm gonna quote you.
Do I have to defend it?
Yes. What does this mean? No, but are we cheating this next generation out of viable careers? Not everyone can be a successful founder. Given that most startups fail in 5 to 10 years, will we have a generation of self-employed 30-somethings that were chasing their dreams, but were left with not much more than a few failures under their belts? And it kind of is a throwback also to the conversation with Oliver Bogner, right? And he's Forbes 30 under 30, just turned 21, you know, listed with Mark Zuckerberg as one of the most creative millennials in the world. Mm-hmm. But this kind of speaks to that idea of life experience and things like that, and their value, like, after the failure.
Right. And so, you know, I think that I wrote that as a provocation. Obviously, I don't feel like – I don't actually believe that young people shouldn't have entrepreneurial experiences. But the point being that I think we're maybe selling them a bill of goods that might take them down the wrong path. And I think that – I can't tell you how many young people have come up to me, especially in college, saying, I really want to start a company. I don't have an idea. How can I get an idea? I'm like, no, you got it all wrong. You don't start a company – because you want to start a company, you start a company because you have a burning idea inside of you. And so the good news is, so we did a study a few years ago of successful entrepreneurs, high growth, high impact entrepreneurs in the United States. We surveyed 500 of them, found that the average age when they started their company was 40.
Really?
Yeah. So most people, I should have asked you what you would have guessed, but most people say, you know.
I probably would say like 40.
Yeah, right.
Put them in spot on.
Right. Most people say when I talk about the whole age thing, they think, oh, you're just trying to say it to be nice to older people. No, I mean, truly. And they had significant industry experience when they started their companies. And so it's only through having a job, let's say, in manufacturing that you realize that there's a supply chain problem. Or, you know, maybe you have, you're working on some sort of a car issue and you have a certain insight into the way the car industry works and that it could actually work better. Some of these ideas are not sexy to 21-year-olds. They have no clue about why this would be interesting.
Right.
When you're 21... what's your experience? Your world experience is much narrower. You may have great ideas. So to be fair, you will have a different perspective, right? So there's a question of what is more innovative. Is it applying the experiences of somebody who's lived for 30, 40, whatever years, or is it the new perspective? And I think it's really the combination. So it's not one or the other, but just look at WhatsApp. Yeah. That was created by 30-somethings that have had experience at Yahoo, you know. And they didn't do too badly. So
$19 billion.
Yeah, not too badly. So, but I think, so anyway, the point being that I think it's great to encourage students. There is a problem globally. and there has been a problem in not valuing entrepreneurship as a valid career path. And right. so I think globally, I think we really need to encourage that. And I think it's a great thing now that finally there's this buzz. I'm afraid that there's so much buzz that policymakers expect overnight jobs as a result of it. They're just expecting things. And then they're counting the startups. They're not looking at the actual long-term impacts of these things. And it's, right. it takes a long time to build these ecosystems. Silicon Valley has been in progress for exactly. decades and decades. Mm-hmm. So it's not something that happens overnight. And Ooh. So, yeah, I just think that it's a problem. I feel like students get, and young people get stressed. One thing I would tell them is don't be stressed. You have your whole career to start yes. your company. Maybe the first step is if you don't have an idea, work for a startup, get a sense of how a startup works. Work for an established company because they have certain processes and certain things that you may decide is absolutely the way you don't want to do it, but you learn from that right. as well. And,
but if you're over 40, you should be stressed.
Absolutely not. There were twice as many successful founders over 50 than under 25. And there's a lot of people these days, I think, especially with aging baby boomers, getting aged out of their jobs and feeling like they need to stay in the workforce or getting laid off.
Yeah.
What are they going to do now? I'm trying to remember the statistic, but it was something pretty significant. It was over 25%, maybe 30% of people that were kind of going into retirement or coming back out of retirement right. to start companies.
It was something similar, especially when the economy tanked and people were being laid off. Yeah. It was like, I think it was 25% of executives who had been laid off started companies.
Right.
You know,
That might have been the statistic, yeah. yeah. The only thing about that is it sort of also parallels some of the countries that are less innovative focused, where these are startups that are created because of need as opposed to desire, you know, like
right.
this. So when we surveyed these entrepreneurs as well and said, what motivated you to start the company? A lot of times it was, I had this idea, the only way that I can actually see it in the marketplace was to leave my company because it was just not the right place for it. But if you're out of a job and like, okay, now I'm going to have to start a company, it's this, it's not the right place to be starting yes. from.
Yeah, no, but I 100% agree.
I could discourage it.
Yeah. No, exactly. It's like, we recently interviewed Kyle Cease, and I think I told you about mm-hmm. that conversation, but you know, it's kind of like, don't start from the place of lack, right? Mm-hmm. You start from the place of like, where do you want to be? And yeah. even asking that in the more positive light, and as far as like what am I passionate about, what is that burning desire in me, right. and not like what is the need, like, oh, I need to pay my rent or my mortgage.
It's
like,
well, and okay. here's the other thing is, so what if every single person in the country started their own company? How's that a good idea?
Yeah.
Who's going to work for these companies?
It's called, collaborative community? The Ubers and the Washios of the world. It's like everybody can, you know.
Well, that's kind of where we're going. In some ways, everybody is their own boss, their own brand, freelance. Everyone's freelance, especially in yeah. LA. That's what it feels like, right? But it's, and no doubt, that's the direction it's going. And with the millennials graduating and realizing that the job market is incredibly tight and this huge percentage of millennials not getting the jobs right out of college, going right. back and living with their, what do they call it, adult adolescents or something? They're going back to live with their parents because they can't afford it, you know?
But that's not new. So like to me, I don't know what the numbers are behind it, but I feel like I have friends that you know I graduated with from school, and like some of them went home. Like,
well,
you know,
yeah, but the numbers are staggering now, and I think that younger people, they if they don't already figure this out, they better learn that they need to take a more entrepreneurial view of themselves. So I don't think that necessarily everybody has to start their own company, but I think that they need to think of themselves as sort of a company or an entrepreneurial, like a startup of one.
Yeah.
And start from that point and say, well, who am I?
I don't want to go too far down this road. Like, when I went to school when I was 17, right, my freshman year, I didn't know who I was. You know what I mean? Yeah. I didn't know what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. And right. very few people do. Like, there are some people that are like, yeah, when I was 6 years old, all I dreamt of was flying planes, you know? but you know, for me, that wasn't.
I want to be a magician at one point. Right?
Well, you're making magic happen on this show.
Thank you.
Davos, you just yep. got back.
I did. It was a pretty wild experience. It was, you have world leaders for coming in, buzzing in on the helicopters all week long, and coming in, doing their little. Yeah, no. And then, a real, a lot of the real action happens out of the Congress Center and the back rooms and, you know, suites in the hotels and who knows what's going on in some of those places. And sometimes I feel like, you know, I'm considered, you know, an academic. I brought in innovation experts, et cetera. We're brought in as entertainment in a way, you know what I mean?
Dance.
Right. And I think that some of the sessions that I led were incredibly popular. And I think that, you know, people were really enjoy the more interactive. So what's really neat about some of the sessions that you don't hear about, so you can see the live stream in Davos, which is you'll see Rouhani speak or John Kerry speak or whoever. But and those are the sort of very large speakers. Then you have these sessions that are much more interactive where you do workshops right. and you actually work with other really fascinating people to try to develop new ideas and to advance ideas. And those are really fun. I really enjoy those. And those are the ones that I'm usually involved in. And then you have these parties and after parties all night long that are just nutty and... Mary J. Blige played the Google party for like 150 people. Yeah. Nice. And then you have other artists who it's like, who are they again? And they, the poor things, you know, they're probably paid a lot of money to fly to Davos and they're, you know, like, all right, I'm just getting paid for this.
Yeah. Like kind
of
strumming along on the guitar. Right? Exactly.
But, and like nobody in the audience knows who they are, even though they used to be pretty famous, you know?
So what are some of the, you know, just an example maybe of some of the tangible things that come out of the World Economic Forum? Like, is it just kind of like, let's get together and, you know, is it like summer camp or is it tied to a goal or measurement or you know, hard results?
So like for me, I had some meetings with, you know, ministers and policymakers in some countries and helping them maybe... with thinking about entrepreneurship, for example. So I'm the chair of the Global Agenda Council for fostering entrepreneurship, and they the idea is to really help, you know, stimulate and encourage entrepreneurship around the country. So that's right. part of my role, and then leading some sessions that would then end up leading to, sometimes they lead they lead to reports. Sometimes just the fact of bringing people together,
right.
is really important. So you bring people together from very different and sharing these ideas. And then, of course, there's deals that are happening at a more, you know, global scale. And so that I would not be privy to.
You will. Don't worry. So the show is called Innovation Crush. Is there any innovation currently that you're crushing on? Like you think is something out there that either a company or a person or a trend you've seen that you're like, that is bananas.
Yeah. I mean, what I'm the most passionate about is the idea of how to tap into talent in new ways. Mm-hmm. So it's not a technological innovation as much as now that, everything's so global, hyper-connected, you have this opportunity. I mean, everything from, I don't know. Mechanical Turk it has its negatives, right? But just right. the fact that you can, in a way, commoditize labor in such a crazy way. But then on the other hand, you have people that you can tap into the knowledge of people. So that's obviously crowdsourcing. I call it crowd scaling when you do right. things like, look at GoPro. Who would be a better marketing force than the people who use your product and put these unbelievably insane videos online,
right.
you know, base jumping, whatever. You don't have to pay anyone to base jump. They're doing it for you. And they're putting the videos online and they go viral. So I think that, to me, that's the most exciting idea is new ways of harnessing talent and empowering them
yep.
to move your mission and your ideas forward.
That's great. Is there any trend that you wish would go away, like selfies or... Or me and Robert.
Oh gosh, off the top of my head. I mean, so for me, it's not an innovation, but it's more just pride. I think that pride is one of the biggest enemies of innovation and enemies of peace and happiness in the world. So
I love that.
I'd love to see that go away.
My pride is waning now that
ego is bad.
So if I want to cyber stalk you or if our listeners want to cyber stalk you, how can they do, where can they find you on the interwebs?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter, Christina Holly. That's spelled KristinaHolly.
Got it.
Yeah.
All right. Well, everyone, that has been another awesome, awesome conversation on Innovation Crush. We thank you for stopping by, Z.
Thank you.
And we will talk to you all next time.
If you like listening to comedy, try watching it on the internet. The folks behind the Sideshow Network have launched a new YouTube channel called Wait For It. It's got interviews with comedians like Reggie Watts, Todd Glass, Liza Schleichinger, Slicinger. I've been friends with her for 10 years. One of the funniest people out there, and I still have a hard time with the last name, Liza. Our very own Owen Benjamin, that's me, takes you on a musical journey down internet rabbit holes and much more. You don't have to wait any longer. Just go to youtube.com/waitforitcomedy. There's no need to wait for it anymore because it's here and it's funny. And I love you.